Yes, this is Englishman, Colombian and German. They all walk into a stadium and who knows what happens next. You're listening to the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB+, on podcast via Audio Boom and Spotify. We're everywhere. My name's Alan Wares. AD has disappeared to the frozen wastelands of the West Midlands, to the potteries to get cold and watch the Albion get stuffed. This show's brought to you in association with OldFootballShirts.com. We thank Phil Shelley for his ongoing support. Thanks, mate. Last Saturday, we achieved a rare distinction this season, a league win, courtesy of the double we completed over West Ham United. 6 goals, 6 points from the unhappy Hammers this season, topped off with what must surely be the goal of the month, if not goal of the season contender from Jose Izquierdo. This week, as Attila would proudly sung at the Builder Bonfire evening in April, it's Stoke away, it's Stoke away. In the Premier League, it's Stoke away. I'm not singing anymore. Sadly, the Albion women crashed out the FA Cup this to a very strong Manchester City side by the respectable margin of 2-0, and they face the London Bees at home tomorrow at Culver Road. And as it's LGBT History Month, we'll also be hearing from Football for Your Homophobia campaign director Louise Englefield, and she'll be joining me in the studio today are two long-standing Albion fans. We happily welcome back Tim Vince and Justin Brentnell. Gentlemen, how are we?
Very good, thanks, Al.
Yes, fine, thank you, fine.
Fantastic. Tim, yes. Now then, last time you were on, it didn't quite go to plan in here, did it?
Are you talking about the Nottingham Forest game?
Do tell. I mean, bearing in mind that no one has ever heard this, do tell the ladies and gentlemen what happened without swearing, without sort of resource.
Okay.
Go on.
I was watching the game in the King and Queen where I ran into Alan and I think AD as well. Yeah. And we were so overjoyed with the Ujoa's last minute winner.
Yeah.
One or two beers had been consumed in the course of the.
Who knew?
In a pub. Who would have thought it? Yes. And we thought it would be a really great idea to go and do a Radio Reverb show. So we went up to the studio and I think we had about 8 or 9 attempts to record something. There was lots of...
It was a bit weird, wasn't it?
and I said, has it ever been broadcast?
Yes. The thing is, it's just one of those things of... Well, we were kind of overcome with joy. And you think, oh, let's go to the studio and let's do something. And, well, frankly, I think they would have killed the show if it ever had been aired.
Yeah,
It was a great afternoon.
It was a great afternoon, yes. That's right, yes, yeah.
Okay, you knew nothing of this, did you, Justin?
No, I was in Nottingham, actually. And, I didn't know a lot about anything because I had drunk a few beers in celebration and I can't really remember getting back, but yeah.
I wouldn't want it to be known that actually the Albion fans have a drink problem, but...
We can't get enough of it.
Not as such, no. I mean, it's kind of one of those things. So, Tim, tell us about, seeing as it's been a while since you've been on, and the aborted attempt from, what is it now, nearly 4 years ago, tell us about your Albion supporting history, because the Albion are not your first love, are they?
I wouldn't say first love. That's pushing it a bit. But no, I'm not from Sussex. I didn't move down to Sussex until I was 8. And when I was a young lad, I supported Chelsea, it has to be said, and another team from the Croydon area.
Chelsea from the Croydon area.
Well, a team from the Croydon area. Yeah, Crystal Palace. My dad was a staunch Palace fan, as was his father before him. Dear. My old man really did say, be a Palace fan.
And yeah, please don't repeat what your response
I said, oh, really, father, I'd rather support Chelsea.
And, what era are we talking about here?
Oh, this is the mid-60s.
Right.
And then when I moved down to Lancing, my parents got divorced and I moved to Lancing. And my new friends...
Croydon to Lancing. You know how to live, don't you?
That's exactly right, yeah. My new friends took me to see Brighton play. And this has been 1960... This was 1966, just before England won the World Cup.
Yeah.
And they were all... We went with some... I was, 8 years old. And myself and some older boys, some 9-year-olds, some 8 and 9-year-olds, we took ourselves off to the Goldstone.
Right.
And if you think about what... would happen now, a group of 8, 9-year-old boys turning up unaccompanied at the Amex.
Well,
it would be in the police, have been the papers. No one batted an eyelid back in the 60s. And so I still supported Chelsea, really. But I used to go and watch the Albion when I couldn't go and see the proper football at Stamford Bridge. And that carried on, but I gradually became more and more and more of a Brighton fan. And the last game I went to as a Chelsea fan was the 72 League Cup final against Stoke. And I remember looking at it thinking, oh, I wish this was Brighton.
Was that the kind of nut final now in your coffin then, when they lost the cup final to
Stoke City? No, yeah. I was more a Brighton fan. My dad got me the tickets for the League Cup final, but I couldn't really say to him, "Oh, sorry, Dad, no, I'm a Brighton fan now. I don't want to come watch Chelsea anymore."
Well, I mean, it's like, you know, I suppose, you know, the equivalent of I don't know, maybe coming out. I mean, did your father ever accept you being a Brighton fan? I mean, or did he disown you? Or
we had a few. He was okay, because my granddad had seen Palace play before they played at Selhurst Park. They used to play at a ground called the Nest, which is where
the Selhurst depot is now.
Yeah,
isn't
exactly
it? Yeah.
Right, yeah. Exactly right, where the Selhurst railway depot is now. And this is like, yeah, back in the 90s. Yeah, before the after the First World War, and I remember once though going down to a Brighton game at the height of the rivalry, and I'd stayed with my dad in where he lived in just outside Croydon, and we were in the pub outside East Croydon Station, which isn't there anymore, and full of all the Palace thugs saying what they were going to do to Brighton,
setting fire to things.
Yeah, and my dad said in a very loud voice, "Better not tell them you're a Brighton fan, eh, Tim?" I'm going, "Yeah, Dad." Just, as if I'd be in a pub being a Brighton fan.
Justin, have you ever had these problems, or has Brighton always been your first love?
I think they've always been my first love. I remember my first memories of knowing what a football team were and was probably around 1983 with seeing kind of various older kids wearing the Brighton shirt. And so the seagull has always kind of resonated with me.
Are you from Brighton?
I'm not. My family are, but I'm from Mid Sussex. That's okay. Where I'm born and bred.
Right. Okay. So, do you remember your first game?
Yeah. It was. It wasn't until I was about 14, and it was against Blackburn at the Goldstone, and we won about 3-1 or something. Yeah.
So we're talking mid-80s here.
No. This was about 1992, that sort of time. Okay. Kenny Dalglish was manager of Blackburn.
Colin Hendry might have been playing.
Speedy.
Yeah. Before Shearer.
Yeah. Well, before it was when they had that initial pump of money and they were getting into the.
The thing is, I remember that as a game we lost 3-0, and I think that rather than 1-3, I'll take your word for it, but. Because, like I say, you never forget your first game.
I did. I've the clue we played.
I think you're right. I think I'm muddling up with the South End game I went to, kind of a couple of weeks before or something. So yeah,
it all blurs, doesn't it? I mean, it's 25 years on. Yours is 50 years.
Over 50 years, I've been going.
Well, should we go back a week then and see how your memory is then? When we played West Ham United, there was one change to the lineup from 3 days earlier, as Knockhart was preferred to Solly March. And Brighton sort of made a bright enough start, and I've just put on my notes here, a clattering tackle from Cresswell on AK leaves him in a heap on the floor. Referee plays a good advantage and Gross feeds Murray, who finishes Buckley-esque for the opening goal. Buckley-esque? I mean, do you know what I'm referring to?
Yes, after the game against Doncaster, maybe. Yes, no, I totally agree.
I think... Not for one moment did I think Glenn Murray was going to score when he ran towards the ball with that, which is kind of a testament to how brilliant he is. But for me, the man who made that move was the referee, Roger East. Aaron Cresswell, I think, had seen Grosch in a bit of space, he'd seen Murray in space, and he thought to himself, it's time to take one for the team. So he clattered poor Nocky. Nocky's rolling around at the floor, he's got his arm in the air, he's probably thinking to himself,
he does that quite well.
Again, I'll feel my leg, again, and I will never walk again.
Is he Welsh?
The Welshman Nocky. And it's very tempting for the referee at that point to, and I think he had the whistle in his mouth to blow up, because the foul was, you know, very aggressive. But he doesn't. He just waits that little moment. Grosch brilliantly plays it into space, and Murray's kind of out on his own.
I think West Ham have stopped at this point, haven't they?
They haven't they? They're expecting the foul to be given.
Yeah.
And the icing on the cake for me was that afterwards scored the goal. He returned
turned to sort of Aaron Cresswell, and it didn't end well for him. He ended up Aaron Crestfallen because he was booked.
You've been working on that one. Tim, I mean, you've seen the tackle. I mean, do you think it was late? It was from behind. I mean, it wasn't studs, but he did clash. And do you feel there was a case for a red card there?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those ones where you've seen reds given for that sort of thing, and maybe it's because it was quite early in the game, the yellow was the right decision. But yeah, I've seen reds for those. And as I say, I've got to agree with Justin. That was the referee.
Only thing he did do right.
Yeah, total kudos to him. He was. You can see when you saw a match of the day, he's got his whistle in his mouth and he's just about to blow, and then you see him waving the play on, and Murray finishes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, it was just a. Yeah. Just knew it was going to be a good day then. I think the whole game, it was I've been apprehensive, but up until the Southampton game, I probably had a 60-40 to maybe,
We'll get something out of that game.
Yeah. No, to struggle for the rest of the season.
Oh, right.
Now I'm 60-40. You know how football fans are. So bipolar, up or down. Now I'm 60-40. Yeah, after the Southampton and the West Ham one. That's it now, we'll be in Europe next year. Yeah.
Are you bipolar enough that you think that actually Houghton's time is up? I mean there is a small groundswell of people who do like to change their bed sheets on a regular basis.
Yes, good expression.
Yeah, of people who sort of think, if we lose the game or we're staring at the trapdoor, that we need to change our manager in order to survive. Do you with the current incumbent, do you subscribe to that theory?
Not in the slightest, not even close to it. I think Andy Naylor made a very good point in the Argus, where he said that if Brighton hadn't been, we were expecting to struggle this year, let's be honest. Nobody thought we were going to be mid-table. Mm. And at one stage, I think we were as high as eighth, weren't we?
Yeah.
That was, because we've slumped down from there to a more realistic place, that's panicked a lot of people.
Yes.
Whereas had we always been about we'd always been about where we are now, this sort of level, none would have batted an eyelid. So no, I cannot believe, I've seen the posts on North Stand chat from a few people saying, oh yeah, maybe it's time's up. But it's just, I cannot tell you the contempt I hold those people in.
They are ridiculous on that. I think Houghton is also, if the worst was to happen, he is the best man to get us promoted next season.
Like Burnley did with Sean Dyche.
That seems to be the sort of the go-to consideration here is that, we can follow the model of Burnley. And I think, I think that's also sort of double justified. Is not only did he get them back up, is that they're thriving. They're the ones that are actually nipping at the heels of the top six. A little bit surprisingly, maybe. But you get to I don't think anyone's particularly a fan of, it's not exactly tippy tappy football, but it's effective, and Burnley are doing really well.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I'm with that. So if the worst comes to the worst and we do get relegated, look, we're Brighton have Albion, we've stared oblivion in the face. Getting relegated from the Premier League is not the end of the world.
No, quite.
And I would hate it if I don't think Tony Bloom is the type of person to panic. That's the other great thing we've got. In modern football, you might moan about this, but it's not just the player, it's not just the managers. You need that off-field setup as well. And we are so lucky. Thank you, God, for Tony Bloom. And thank you, God, for Paul Barber as well, to a certain extent, who also is a bit of a pantomime villain and gets a lot of abuse. But,
To be fair, he does have the hide of a rhino, and I think he needs it as well.
Yeah.
Because, like I say, I mean, there's I think that what people are doing is that they're comparing the way that the club was run under Dick Knight, and it was kind of a little bit of open free-for-all. I mean, whilst it's good to have access to your board of directors and actually have what you want listened to and know it's being listened to, I kind of have a feeling that sometimes, don't get me wrong, I love Dick Knight to bits, is that sometimes there was... unprofessional was a bit strong, but there are times when you think, blimey, I wouldn't normally have done that in that way. You think that certain things need to be kept behind closed doors, the element of sub rosa. And so, these days I think that the club is a lot more professional, but because it's a bit more aloof for it, that's what upsets people.
I think in the Premier League you have to have that level of professionalism, and I think we've got one of the best CEOs in the country, and we're very lucky.
I think if you look at Sheffield Wednesday, for argument's sake, you want an example of a club who have got the wrong manager, the wrong owner, and the wrong chairman.
Oh, they've got the wrong. They've got the wrong CEO now.
Yes,
they've
just
appointed Catherine Mayer.
I mean, you just look at that, and you just, we couldn't be better served by the players we've got. And I know that people say, we were just sucking up to the club. Not in the slightest. I genuinely think that, and I've criticised Paul Barber in the past on North Stand Chat. I think he's got decisions wrong, but Well, I stand back and applaud, really.
Well, which person gets 100% right?
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, okay, get back to the West Ham game. 29 minutes in, West Ham have got back into it a little bit. Hernandez finds space in the area, sends three players the wrong way before planting an unstoppable rasp into the top corner. Now, there's an air of consideration here that thinks that the Albion defended poorly. Do you think that actually Hernandez did brilliantly or the Albion defended poorly? Which side of the fence do you guys sit on?
I think there's a bit of a running theme with Hernandez's goal, and I think I don't really want to describe it as defending poorly, but I think there's been certain moments in certain matches this season where our defence sort of, when a top quality player, which Hernandez is, gets the ball, they kind of freeze because they don't know what he's going to do, and he had too much time kind of weaving in the box before he released that shot, and there were kind of players didn't know whether to dive or to go in for the tackle or to jockey him, and he had it just a bit too easy. But that said, I thought it was a fantastic goal, and with that kind of buying power West Ham have and that quality of player, there is always risk that will happen.
He's just said, well, I want
to say basically, so effectively 6-2-3s here. Yeah, brilliantly done, but you know, the Albion players, I think the Albion players were genuinely, I hark back to, and I mean, probably the best goal I've seen where someone sent players to the shop. If you rewind back to Euro 2016, and it was Hal Robson-Kano, of all people, who playing for Wales, sent three Belgian defenders to the shop by doing a Cruyff turn in the penalty area before planting the ball into the back of the net. Hernandez didn't do a Cruyff turn, but the little jink sends one player that way, one player the other way.
Not the sort of goal you'd concede in a championship, is it? There's no one have that sort of ability, really.
No, I agree with that.
I mean, if we'd have scored it, we'd be screaming about it,
yeah,
I think.
Definitely. Yeah. And again, the thing that annoyed me was again, it wasn't one of the players, it was actually watching Match of the Day later, and it was a commentary by Jonathan Pearce, when he said, oh, that was coming, and yeah, that was coming about as much as Father Christmas in August. They had one or two little chances that were, you know...
they had a chance headed off the line.
Yeah, yeah.
And they had a fairly easy header which went over the bar.
Yeah.
I thought at that point, you know, because it's just one of those things at the time, and I tweeted it at the time, and people looking back on it say it was harsh, bearing in mind our second half performance, or rather more West Ham's second half performance, is I actually thought, after the goal, I thought we were a little bit sloppy. There was elements of... We scored our goal fairly early on, and we did like we did against Southampton, and then not stop playing, but ball retention was just poor.
Yeah, but not to the extent that it was coming. But I agree with you. We did take our foot off the gas, and I think if you look at the amount of times we've scored first this season, and then the other team have come with an equaliser, which I have to say is one of the disappointing things this season.
Yes.
Luckily, Houghton was able to kind of sort the team out at half time and say, right, you know how you started the first half. That's got to happen again.
Absolutely. Yeah, come firing out. Mm. And talking of which, 14 minutes into the second half, Brighton have a corner. Ball is headed into, or clear, crossed into the area, headed clear. And there's Izquierdo on the corner of the penalty area. Who wants to go first?
Oh, go on, Justin. Yeah.
It's just a thing of beauty. Just a thing of beauty.
Notes just say 59 minutes.
the level of skill needed to do that. I mean, he picks the ball up. He's got to work out where he's aiming, because he's put so much curl on it, and he's put so much dip on it, and so much pace. It's just the way it fits into, you know, the keeper doesn't quite get. There's only a tiny, tiny gap for it to go to, which is probably about the size of the football itself.
Yes.
It is
postage stamp.
It's a postage stamp. It's a key in a,
I think
a
the
lock,
thing that makes the goal look, Tim, the goal look even better was the fact that the keeper was. If the keeper had just left it,
yeah, yeah.
But the fact that the keeper went flying up for it, and to be fair, did his best.
Yes, yeah.
And like I say, the number of people said it's the only place he could have put it. I mean, if he'd gone for the near post, it would have been cleared. I mean, it went fly. You know, as Justin said, so
it was a phenomenal. It was a phenomenal goal. And I don't know if you've seen. There's a bit of camera footage taken by a West Ham fan from behind the goal that I've seen, and one of his West Ham fans goes, "He's done it again."
Well, it's good memory then. Yeah,
yeah, that's right.
There was another interesting thing on North Stand chat. Someone's taken a series of photo snaps of it, of the ball's flight in the air, and the height he gets on it as well. It's not only the curl, it goes so high, and then it kind of reaches its pinnacle, and then it almost accelerates back down again. It was just amazing.
You're saying it's a goal that defies the laws of physics?
Better than Beckham. Yeah. You heard of bend it like Beckham. That was better than Beckham.
Better than bending it like Beckham.
As if there was a little alien in the ball piloting it there was that much control on the ball.
Yeah.
It was brilliant. And the celebration was justified. Yes. And the yellow card.
Yeah, he took one for the team. The hilarious thing is that Matt Ryan came flying out of the goal. And by the time he got anywhere near him, Izquierda had gone completely the other way, so that the U-turn, you know, you could hear this screech of Blake breaks as Ryan turns back to him and eventually catches it. If he hadn't caught him, I'd have convinced that Izquierda would end up at Falmer Station still waving his shirt around. I think he appreciated it at the time. It was a beauty. And what the other thing I really like is that you see the reaction of all the players in the area.
Murray throws his arms up.
Absolutely. Waiting for a cross, but then they see this ball going flying past them. And let's face it, 99% of those end up in row Z, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you say the bend that it came on it, but actually sometimes it bends the other way and it goes out for a throw in. I think it was. For me, in the West Stand upper, it actually made me jump, as if, you know, you saw the net bulge and you think, hang on, that's not supposed to happen. I kind of feel it made the players jump as well. And also, I think that you're talking about pictures of the people have taken, there's a wonderful picture of the ball going in and you can see the West Ham fans behind the goal just as it hits the net. And there's this kind of, almost all of them have got their mouths are circular as if say, oh. How can you, like I say, he's done it again.
I also the split second of when he'd just made contact with the ball, and I could see its kind of trajectory, and I was just about to scream some sort of, that is an appalling cross, what the hell are you doing, that's going nowhere near Murray. But it was at the back of the net before I was able to verbalise that thought.
Okay, and on 75 minutes, Proper feeds Gross, who takes a touch, he's past his man, and fire a shot into the bottom corner from 20 yards. Now, but for Izquierdo's goal, we'd have said, actually, Gross's was pretty good, wasn't it?
Well, there were four good goals in that game. Not a single sort of scuffed tap-in sight. All four goals were absolutely fantastic, really. And, yeah, that was just Gross. What a buy. What a signing. Yeah, again, I think, just to go off the topic a bit here, when the recruitment team didn't sign a striker, striker gate, it was, the recruitment team, they're useless. And they're not at all, are they? Because, I mean, look at the players they've brought in. That Gross and Proper have been absolutely fantastic. There hasn't been a single duff signing this year. Not one.
I agree with that. I thought Grosch's goal was incredibly clever, and I think he was interviewed afterwards, and he said he wanted to kick it through the defender's legs. But what actually happened was when he received the ball, he had Joa sort of buzzing around him like a bee around a daisy. And I think the West Ham players didn't quite know what was going to happen, and they were going to think, is it going to go to Joa? And there was also a defender in front of the keeper, and Grosch knew the whole time what he was going to do, and he actually kicked it the other side of the goal where you wouldn't really expect him to kick. He kicked it through a defender's leg. The keeper didn't even see it. He got nowhere near it, and it was also outside the box, and it also had a lot of power on as well. And
So we scored three goals. Well, why couldn't we have done that all the other weeks? Look how easy it was.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing is that in the second half, West Ham, I thought, were atrocious.
Yeah, they
were.
They
were poor.
Yeah.
They didn't even have, not even on target, they didn't have a shot on goal at all in the second half.
I think that's why I'm now so confident, really. I've gone bipolar. I've gone, we're absolutely fine now. I'm so confident that we will not be
Europa
anywhere
League,
near the
here
bottom.
We come,
That's right. We're not even anywhere near the bottom three coming this season. I'm going to regret this, though, probably.
I know, we're playing Stoke away this afternoon.
Yeah, exactly.
Who knows what's
another 2-0 defeat like West Brom, and another performance like West Brom,
and I'll Huddersfield
Huddersfield, absolutely. Yes, and I'll be the bipolar will switch the other way,
and beer will taste horrible again.
Yes, indeed.
There's a theme there, though, isn't there? Which is our away performances, which have I know we nicked a win at Swansea, and actually West Ham was pretty good, but aside from those two, we haven't been brilliant away, and I do fear today that people like Shaqiri will turn up and
It's funny that I think the best away, although I wasn't there, but the best away performance has apparently been Man United and Arsenal. Okay, we lost.
We were decent against Arsenal, but Man United, we should have got something from that game.
Yeah, as that was
Okay, right, it's time for our weekly shirt of the week. This ALBM Raw is brought to you in association with oldfootballshirts.com, and Phil Shelley, our generous sponsor of the Raw, provides us with a shirt out of the 84,000 on his site to wax lyrical about the shirt and the history of the team in question. Now, normally AD would have a colour print out of it, but I don't have that, so I'm going to show this shirt to Tim.
Oh, good grief, that is hideous.
Okay, that's Tim's best description of it. I'll pass it to Justin. Could you try and describe it apart from hideous?
Okay, well, the shirt is vertical stripes of different widths. There are three colours. One is a kind of quite vile yellow. The others are kind of a pinky red. These are all very bright colours, and the others are a darkish green. There seems to be what appears to be the Barcelona club logo right in the centre, but I don't think it is. It's sponsored by a company called Mateus.
Right. Any ideas then, Tim?
None whatsoever, fortunately. But I tell you what, if they're bright and they ever have a shirt like that, I'll go back to Sporting Palace.
It is a bit on the noisy side, and Phil will be posting this on Facebook. Here's what he says about this week's shirt. This is the 2009-2010 home shirt of Brazilian side São Paulo Correia. They play in the 75,263 capacity Estadiado Governador João Castelo, simply known as the Castelão. The stadium was opened in 1982 and hosted internationals and CONMEBOL League finals, like the Champions League final for the South America. They come from the city of São Luís, the capital state of Maranhão, on the northern coastline of Brazil. I reckon he's put this in knowing that AD's going to try and read this and then trip over it. Sorry, mate, it's me this week. And are nicknamed the Bolivianos due to the fact that their colours are similar to the national colours of Bolivia. The club is actually named after the seaplane called the Sampaio Correia Dois, which visited the city of São Luís in 1922. The plane was piloted by Walter T. Hinton. He was the first man to pilot an aircraft on the transatlantic flight in 1919. The team has a nondescript history. In 1972, they won the Brazilian second division, but no promotion was offered. And they won the regional Copa Norte, I think that's just the North Cup, in 1998. They don't appear to have any famous current or ex-players, although I would imagine that some will tell me that Yuri Scalac or Jason Malumbi both turned out for their under-21 team at some point. I think that's Phil having a little bit of a grizzle there, because, well, a couple of weeks ago he put up a shirt of FC Metz, and we pointed out that, don't get me wrong, Phil's research on this is wonderful, and when he does the shirt of the week, you know, it's something for us to talk to visually on the radio. It works perfectly. His research is normally astonishingly good, and he missed out on the fact that both Bong and Alexei Frutos both started at Metz. So thanks for that very much indeed, Phil. February is LGBT History Month, and we're delighted to be joined by Campaign Director for Football v Homophobia. It's a welcome back to Louise Englefield. Lou, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. I'm good. Nice to be back.
Yeah.
Missed the show last season, I think. So yeah, it's always good to be back on the show.
Well, we don't want to be too greedy with having you on.
To Brighton people, which is, of course, where the Football versus Homophobia campaign originated. So, you know, feels like a bit of a, you know, a bit of a home, a home match coming on Albion Raw.
Fantastic. Actually, I was just going to say, in that case, for those of us, like I say, you missed out on us last year. So tell us about the history of the campaign of Football v Homophobia.
Yeah, sure. So Football versus Homophobia was a campaign that was set up by a small voluntary organisation in Brighton. Of LGBT activists who basically wanted to do something about homophobia, biphobia and transphobia in football. And the campaign was kind of basically commemorating the memory. The Justin campaign was called that because it was kind of a legacy of Justin Fashanu, who was the first out professional footballer in the UK. His story was quite sad, you know, he was hounded by the press. And the founder of Justin campaign, Jason Hall, wanted to do something positive with his memory and tackle HBT, you know, homophobia, biphobia, transphobia in football.
So how did it go then from the Justin campaign, something that's fairly localised, albeit probably, you know, reached out on a national level, but how did it get to go from the Justin campaign to this national campaign, Football v Homophobia?
Yeah, well, I think, to be honest, when they launched the campaign in 2010, it immediately had a really, really big impact. But the Just In campaign was a small campaign with people who were doing other work. You know, it wasn't their day jobs, but they were just a small group of volunteers. And basically, the campaign became really big, really quickly, because it was absolutely the right time, you know, and the campaign got messaging behind it as well. You know, it does what it says on the tin. It was really clear, you know, we want to tackle homophobia. So it became quite big quite quickly. My organization, so the organization behind Football Versus Homophobia now, is an organization called Pride Sports. We're a tiny organization, and the Just In campaign approached us in, I think, 2012 and said, you know, would we give them a helping hand that season? So we kind of joined for 2012. And then I think probably 2013, 2014 season, we ended up taking over then full time. And we've been running it ever since. So.
Great stuff. For those listening, I think you'll probably realise that Lou isn't in the studio here. She's based in a friend's place at the moment in the East Midlands. So if you can hear sort of the voice cutting out now and again, then do bear with us. But I think the message is still being got across. So February has been designated LGBT History Month. Tell us about what you're hoping to achieve by designating it that. What's that all about?
Well, LGBT History Month is something that is a kind of initiative that is not specifically about football. It's which is about acknowledging the contribution of lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender people to society across the world. I mean, it was started in the UK, but I believe that it's now reaching other countries. And really, our month of action coincides with LGBT History Month. That's very handy for us. You know, it's really good because there's some other great stories being told out there outside of football. But our month of action really coincides with LGBT History Month because the Just In campaign originally launched an international day against homophobia and transphobia in football. And that was on Justin Fashanu's birthday in the middle of February. Mm-hmm. They launched it as a single day. But, you know, you can't really have a huge amount of impact if you just have a single day, because what if matches aren't taking place on that day? You know, there could be a million things going on. So fairly early in the campaign, we were asked to extend this day of action to a week of action. So then it became 2 weeks of action. And now we have a month of action in February, but obviously, or maybe not, we're working year round on these issues. But yeah, you know, really great fit with LGBT History Month from our perspective as well.
Sure. What do you expect of football clubs to get involved with the February, you know, the month of campaigning?
Well, there's a whole load of different things we do. You know, one of the things that we do is encourage clubs to designate games. They can, you know, they just can message out information in a match day programme or over at Hanoi or on their website. Really, you know, designated games are about reaching fans and giving a message to fans about making football more inclusive. But equally, we run a whole range of education campaigns. So, for example, we educate scholars, football scholars, so trainee footballers in academies. We've done some work with them. We've also worked with professional clubs, community foundations, and trained their community foundation staff, because in local communities, football clubs have such a massive reach, you know. They're going out into schools, they're going out into youth clubs, and so they are every single day of the week meeting children and young people. So community foundations can be a really fantastic way of getting your message across, really. And, you know, we know at the campaign that some children will start using homophobic language in the playgrounds when they're playing football around the age of 10 years old. So we think that working with children is really, really important.
Working on the assumption that no one is born racist and no one is born homophobic, I mean, obviously there's going to be places where these sorts of things are picked up. And so this is part of an educational sort of programme to say, look, you know, this is not acceptable and please don't behave like this.
Yeah, totally, 100%. And, you know, the earlier we can catch young people and give them a bit of different messaging about the language that they're using, you know, the better, really, because, you know, you have a child saying something completely unintentionally at the age of 10. By the time they're saying it at the age of 15, it's become really bad, you know. So if you can talk to children, educate them, at a young age, then you know, then that stands you in really, we believe anyway.
Sure. Like I say, if you're listening to Lou here, like I say, you can tell she's not in the studio. So like I say, I do apologise for the sound cutting out a little bit, but I think, like I say, her message is certainly being got across here. There's something that's fairly new that's cropped up within football, which I think that certainly at least there's an affiliation with football v homophobia here, is that there's now a number of proud fans groups up and down the country. So what's their aim? What would they like to achieve as a group that sets itself apart as proud fans?
Well, so basically what in the last, I kind of think, three seasons, I may be getting this wrong and then I'll be in trouble. But over the last about three seasons, what we've seen is a shift in LGBT plus fans group at some of the biggest clubs in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And they all started, the first fan group was Gay Gooners at Arsenal.
Right.
And then they were followed by, I think, Proud Canaries at Norwich.
Yeah.
Proud Lily Whites. Anyway, now there are 40 LGBTs up and down the country at the major clubs. And I think, to summarise the aims of those groups, it's about bringing 4 years, because we can be, LGBT people can be an invisible, so we can be ignored. Back in the day, you used to hear the argument when people used homophobic language in football. Well, you know, we're not saying it's gay people, are we? So it doesn't matter. I think LGBT fans will stand about bringing LGBT people are a part of football and belong in football. And I think that is having a huge impact on fans personally. You know, I think that's making a real... If you look at, you know, for example, at the Etihad, Canal Street Blues banner is up on, is digitally displayed around the stadium for every single home game.
Sure.
You know, at Hart Lane, you know, their banner was physically displayed really close to the corner flag. So, you know, you could see the banner during televised games. You know, it's just about saying there are people who are here who are LGBT and we are part of the football family.
I mean, additional to that, I mean, you know, following on from that, I mean, you pointed me in the direction of a blog from West Ham fans, their LGBT group, Pride of Irons, and they wrote about they wrote an article about their experience with their fellow fans at the Amex. Now we'll talk about in a minute about you know, what Brighton fans have been through, but I mean, let's tell us about that particular article and how that was dealt with. You know, sort of the nonsense that kicked off amongst West Ham fans and their own the way they dealt with it with amongst their own.
Basically, the article is that, you know, before there were LGBT fans groups, LGBT fans were quite isolated because you didn't really know who the other fans were in the stadium.
Mm-hmm.
And the article talks about an away day by Pride of Irons and a group of LGBT fans who were sitting close together in the away end. And I think West Ham had gone 3-0. And then basically what happened was some West Ham fans started to sing, does your boyfriend know you? And started homophobic chanting. And the story that's written, you know, great story, you know, Rican basically describes how actually, you know, several of the Pride of Ireland group turned around to their fellow fans and challenged them. And being part of that fans there just gave those individual fans the confidence to do that and the ability to do that. And the really great thing about the story, I think, is that actually when the fans who were challenged, they stopped. And that's the reality of the situation, I think. I think, you know, if you challenge people, and times out of 10, they will stop, but they're not challenged, you know? So I think the story from Pride of Ireland is a really great example of increasing the visibility of LGBT people, creating a network of LGBT people, can give people confidence in homophobia when it occurs at football. And let's talk about this. It's not just the Amex that it happens, you know?
Sure. I mean, I was about to say, Brighton fans are well used to homophobic abuse. And, you know, it's been in the past euphemistically wrapped up as banter. But when Brighton played Leicester, and let's name a club here, Leicester, earlier in the season, it was highlighted there was some abuse from their fans and some people were arrested and prosecuted. But for us, it's not an uncommon occurrence. But the point is that the press made a big deal of it, possibly because we're now a Premier League club, as if, oh, my God, Brighton are in the Premier League. This is what happens. I mean, do you not find that a bit hypocritical that, you know, the fact it's happened before, but it's only now that we're in the Premier League that it's suddenly become news?
I think, well, you know, it's an interesting one, isn't it? I mean, certainly, you know, people last season saying, oh, you know, this is going to be a real issue when Brighton's in the Premier League. And I was a bit like, well, you know, it's been a real issue at Brighton for years, you know. And it doesn't mean the Premier League or the Championship. You know, homophobia is homophobia and it needs being tackled. I think in the Premier League, that means that gets more attention, that there is more focus to it. And that's definitely an issue. I think there's just so much more awareness than there ever has been before. So I think that there's definitely an increase in reporting. And also, I would say as well, an increase in the issue being taken seriously, you know, and people actually taking action around it, whereas previously they may not have done that. So the issue with the fans and the sanctions earlier on in the season, I think isn't just a result of being in the Premier League. I think it's about being in the Premier League, about action having been taken sort of like in the last couple of seasons, in the build up to it, and people thinking, no, you know, this is serious and it really, really needs to be dealt with. So, you know, and it does.
Sure. So where does Football v Homophobia go from here? We know what your aims are, but, you know, this has to be a kind of societal shift, and there's so far that it can be taken. And if society isn't ready to drop the shackles of homophobia, you know, what's on the immediate horizon for Football v Homophobia?
Well, I think we need to be realistic about cultural change. You know, we are never ever going to completely eradicate homophobia, but what we are looking at is, you know, what you want is the majority of people within the game to find homophobia and discrimination repugnant, you know, and that's when you've won. And what we have started to see is that kind of shift, you know. Like I saw something the other day, you know, where in which some Manchester City fans were talking on Twitter, and one fan was saying that she heard somebody say something really offensive about disabled people, and she challenged it, and she put this out on Twitter, and then the guy responded and went, oh yeah, you know, and the game I was at last week, I had to challenge somebody being homophobic, you know, but he stopped it when I challenged him. And I think that's the thing, that's what we're looking for. You know, it's not that homophobia is never going to happen, it's just that when it does, we need people to stand up and call it out. And I think that Pride in Football, the network of LGBT fans groups, is having a huge impact in this area. So we want to, in the immediate future, carry on working with them, carry on working with that network of fan groups and support the work they're doing, the conversations they're having with their own, you know, with their own fans in their own clubs, because it's really important that they are having good conversations with other fans, non-LGBT fans, and, you know, talking about the issues. I think for us, we are looking at working in other areas. You know, it's not just about fans. Fans play an enormous part in the whole story of challenging homophobia. But, you know, there are still issues around players, around managers, around administrators, you know, referees. You know, we've heard in the last month, we've had reports to us of two guys who've been homophobically abused in grassroots football, mm-hmm. and referees taking no action whatsoever.
Yeah.
Because I'm assuming because they don't understand that, you know, that homophobia on the pitch is a sanctionable offence. So there's still a huge amount of education to be done across the game from our perspective. And so, it, you know, for us, it's about making people, you know, really, really aware, really embedding an understanding for people of what homophobia is, how it impacts people and what they can do to challenge it and make a difference, you know, in their work environment, in their supporting environment, in their playing environment, you know, at whatever level.
Louise Englefield of Football v Homophobia, thank you very much indeed for coming on to the Albion Roar.
Oh, thanks so much for having me back. It's been a treat.
You're listening to the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, on podcast via Audio Boom and Spotify. We're everywhere, and I'm joined in the studio today by Tim Vince and Justin Brentnell. You heard there just now from Louise Englefield of Football v Homophobia. Chance, you got any comments on what you've just heard there?
I think, isn't it great that we're kind of going in the right direction on this? Football is the national game, and it should very much be reflecting the kind of the times in terms of homophobia.
Mm. Tim?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that, and I think when I've talked to gay people outside of Brighton fans who know that we get homophobic abuse for being Brighton fans, and I've said that it's an interesting debate, and where I've said, oh, a response we chant back is you're too ugly to be gay, and I would think the reaction, I haven't spoken to many people about this, but the most laugh and go, ha ha, that's brilliant, but some go, oh, I don't think you should be saying that as well. So it's I think it's brilliant that obviously the awareness is being raised. We've got to counter homophobia, but whether we sometimes go about it the right way or not, I'm not 100% certain.
Yeah, I mean, it's a debate to be had as to what is the most appropriate response, that actually sometimes that using the language that homophobes, you know, and let's face it, we're not talking about particularly intelligent people here, which homophobes actually have, an, you know, will understand, you know, you're too ugly, too big, a gay comes back as banter.
Yeah.
But like you say, I mean, I think there are some people also who want to be offended as well.
Yes.
But by the same token, it's that maybe we should be even more imaginative with a response apart from shut up.
Yes, that's right. I just sound a little bit weedy. Yeah. I'm a homophobic, don't do
weirdly
that.
Enough, I tend to find that you're too ugly to be gay actually does seem to be effective.
Yes.
You know, yeah. Whether it's the right or wrong way to go about
it. It is, because they sort of go,
They've got nowhere to go with it.
What do you mean we're too ugly to be gay?
I'm lovely. No, you're not. You're really not, mate.
So I personally think that we as Brighton fans actually handle it very well as on a general view, and I'd be upset if LGBT fans said, no, you're not doing it right.
Yeah.
I think as a general, I think we are actually, you know, trying to make things better, but we, you know, we've acknowledged it exists. We sort of we're not offended by the chants or anything like that. And
it's usually when it's one-on-one that, you know, when it's when it's a crowd sort of singing it from a distance, you think, oh, grow up. But when it's one-on-one and it's screamed abuse in your face, that's scary.
I think we've all had that where you've had away fans that come out, you know, poof,
We get the gist, but
I won't go any further. But
fair enough, yeah, please don't. Okay, this is the Albion Roar, and it's time for Notice Board. Okay, sort of village notices here. Saturday, 3rd of March, Radio Reverb is hosting its annual Reverbathon. Radio Reverb is a community radio station run by volunteers. Unbelievably, you're not going to believe this, but me and AD don't get paid for doing this. You know, we rely on sponsorship. This show relies on sponsorship, which is where Phil Shelley from Old Football Shirts come in, and we do actually appreciate very much. Hello, Phil. His sponsorship, and like I say, the shirt of the week on a visual section on radio, I think is. Well, it's genius on our part, frankly, isn't it? It's run by volunteers, which survives financially only on donations, grants and sponsorship. So we're going to be asking you to help us keep this brilliant radio station alive. And it is a brilliant radio station because some of the subject matters that we can actually cover here are pretty diverse. I'm thinking of Emma, who has the Frockabilly Show, which is she claims to be, and I'm more than happy to believe her, the only female rockabilly DJ in the country. I'm sure there are others, but I'm not going to argue her claim. And she also has a brilliant show, the Beer and Fermentation Radio Show. I've got to give a shout out to that. I'd love to actually combine the Albion Raw and the Fermentation Show. I mean, at Beer and Footy, what could go wrong? We've got Karen's Food and Drink Show. We have Mental Health Awareness. We have Punk. We have Rock. We have... like I say, LGBT shows out in Brighton is an award-winning show. We have live shows, we have What's On stuff, we have new bands here. It covers so many aspects of Brighton and Hove, and if you can help us to keep this brilliant radio station alive, like I say, completely entirely run by volunteers, that would be brilliant. It's on Saturday, March the 3rd. We don't have a game that day, so if you could actually spare us a few shekels to keep us going, that would be absolutely wonderful. More details later. Thursday, the 29th of March is Renf Quiz Night back at the Heineken Lounge. Justin, you did well last year, didn't you?
I won it, yeah. Oh. All the team won it.
Yeah. How much? Yes, you were late.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think
blame Shandy.
I think we're going to do our best to turn up on time.
I think you will get points docked.
We're going to be quite quiet this time. I think we were a bit rowdy, and so we're going to be on our best behaviour. Honestly.
Oh, that's a shame.
Well, I should be in my usual position as reserve for the Magnificent Seven. So if Kay needs me, I'll be around.
Yeah. Kay, Tim, you need Tim.
But
if you do fancy coming along, you're more than welcome to do so. It's £5 a head to enter. Teams of up to six. Just email me, alan.wares@ntlworld.com. Just to book a team and let me know you're coming. We just need some numbers ahead of time. And Friday, the 11th of May, is the Renf annual charity match. Brighton fans against Palace fans at the Dripping Pan. Brett Mendoza is hosting trials in Kemp Town. Coming up very soon, so get in touch with him at the Caxton Arms, which is where he lives and operates and breathes these days, if you wish to participate. So that's Friday the 11th of May is the annual Brighton fans v Palace fans. I would imagine hopefully Wardy's coming along, certainly Ricky Marlowe will be there. Who Palace are going to bring along as a ringer, we don't know. Who Brighton are going to bring along as a ringer, we don't know.
I played in the very first Renf game, really proud of that.
So you're a Renf winner too?
Yeah, no, we lost 4-3 on penalties.
Oh, where was the game?
Southwick.
It was at Southwick, was it? Okay, yeah. I was like playing on the moon there, isn't it? I suppose so is the Dripping Pan.
It was my fault they equalised in the last minute as well, but I don't dwell on that.
Were you in goal?
No, I was supposed to be on the line and I moved off the line, the ball went over my head, so I was left back.
Oh, tales of yore, it's like the fisherman's tales, isn't it? Yeah, it's like the one that got away. So yes, do come along to that, and all proceeds go to the Robert Eaton Memorial Fund. Tim,
yes,
you're the musician amongst us here.
Yes,
what have you been up to?
Not really. Well, I've recently rejoined two old bands that I used to be in years ago. One of them is an electronic band called Electronic Circus, which started out when a friend of mine, a guy called Chris Payne, who'd been with Gary Newman, and he'd written a hit with two friends of his called Billy Curry Majeur, who's been in an 80s band called Ultravox. Mm-hmm. And they'd written this song called Fade to Grey, which became number seven in the UK, became a huge hit in Europe. And on the back of that, Chris got another little band together, which was myself and some other people he'd worked with in the past, called us Electronic Circus. And because he had this big hit, he sort of stuck his head behind the door of RCA Records, and they sort of bit his hand off, and we got signed up, released a single, bombed completely. We were never heard of again.
Right.
And we thought that was the end of it. And then recently, Chris keeps getting interviewed about his Newman days, about 80s music in general, and he realised these people were asking him all about Electronic Circus. He was thinking, what? That was just like a little project I did with some friends.
It was a garage band. It.
That's right. Yeah, sort of thing, yeah. And we did one little tour supporting his other band, Dramatis, but we never succeeded anywhere. And he realised, people were saying, no, go to YouTube. And he went to looked on YouTube, and there were about 7 videos of Electronic Circus. One of them, a guy had married it with a Bergman film called Summer with Monica. And he put this Electronic Circus song, which was called Direct Lines, over Summer with Monica. And it had 1.5 million plays and 12,000 likes.
So are you saying there's YouTube footage of makeup and...
No, oh no, no, God, I've destroyed all the photos of that. I have destroyed all. There were some horrible photos of me wearing makeup that the record label took. They've all gone.
I just can't imagine it. I can't.
I think one of the last people to have one, I think, was Ian Hart. I think he had one. But then, on the back of this YouTube video, and there was so much interest, an American record label contacted Chris and asked to re-release it. And we got together and formed. We decided to reform the band, Electronic Circus, but get the band back together. So we did.
What could go wrong?
Yes, do good. And we did a gig in Dusseldorf in Germany just before Christmas for a German music festival. And we've got one coming up in April for an English electronic music festival in London. I don't know, but go to Google Electronic Circus, people. Electronic Circus, that's the name, and the dates on there. So that's one, having rejoined that, I then met Attila the Stockbroker in the Evening Star.
Of course, this is his second home.
Yeah, because before Electronic Circus, Chris and I had been in a band called Crucible, which married... we were both huge fans of early music, so we married early music with prog rock and called it Crucible. And we had Hans Zimmer was one of the members of Crucible. I mean, the film producer, Hans Zimmer, was in Crucible.
Keep going.
Yeah, and John was a huge fan, Attila was a huge fan, and he then, when punk came out, he then married it with early music and punk and called it Barnstormer, and I joined the early version of Barnstormer, was in it for 6 years, and then
left. Under the name of?
I was... My stage name?
The stage name.
Tim O'Tay was my stage name, yeah. And I don't normally say that, but I then left because it became more like punk rather than early music. Yeah. But he collared me and said he'd just rewritten a load of early music. Would I come back? So I said yes. So yes, we did our first gig in the Wellington. Because you were there.
I was there, yeah. Yes. Yep. Well, I did the T-shirts.
And you didn't leave. You did the T-shirts.
I did the T-shirts.
Excellent T-shirts.
What were you playing?
I played... This is rock and roll, real rock and roll. I played the recorder.
Fantastic.
different sites.
So if you want to check out Tim's resurgent rock and roll career, go and Google Electronic Circus and check out Barnstorm. I think they're playing in Brighton next week again at the Rose Hill Tavern.
We're at Rose Hill Tavern on Thursday.
Yeah, Rose Hill Tavern, yeah. And then start a tour at the end of March. Yeah. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for. You have been listening to The Albion Raw. Thank you very much indeed for doing so. Thanks indeed to Tim Vince, to Justin Brent, and yes, we'll see you next week. Ada will be back. We'll be talking all things Coventry next week in time for the FA Cup. So we'll see you then. Thanks him very much indeed for listening. And here's our tribute to the late, great Dennis Edwards, who died last week. Cheers. Papa was a rolling stone. Wherever he laid his hat was his home. And when he died, all he left us was alone. Mama, is it true?
what to say that Papa never worked a day in his life. And Mama, some bad talk going around town saying that Papa had 3 outside children and another wife. And that ain't right. Heard some talk about Papa doing some storefront preaching, talking about saving souls and all the time leeching. Dealing in debt and stealing in the name of the Lord. Mama just hold her head and say, Papa was a rolling stone.
Mama looked up with a tear in her eye and said, son,